Well, good morning. I invite you to open the Bible this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. That's where we're going to start in our time together this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Good to see you this morning. We have a lot of visitors with us today. Family in town to see other family and visitors from the community. All sorts of reasons that you have gathered with us today. We're glad that you are here. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I want you to look with me. Verse 14. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain, and your faith is in vain. What do you make of a statement like that? Paul's being awfully honest, isn't he, about the truth of the Christian religion. If Christ has not been raised, then everything else is pointless. Fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, this is a historical religion. This is a historical religion, and its central historical claim is laughable. Laughable 2,000 years ago and laughable today, that God raised somebody from the dead. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul admits that everything hangs on that, however. What do I mean when I say it's a historical religion? What I mean is this. Usually when people think about what it means to be a Christian, we think about it in moral terms, right? We think about it in moral terms, about doing right and not doing wrong. There are a bunch of commands that Jesus has given, the Bible reveals, and that these are the laws, the rules, the commandments that we are to live and order our lives by. But the fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, that when you start thinking about the nature of the commandments the Bible has, the thou shalts and the thou shalt nots, the things that God would have us to do and the things that God would have us to avoid in the name of sin. The fact of the matter is there's a lot of moral overlap with most of the monotheistic religions in the world. The fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, that the Muslims believe adultery is wrong. And the fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, that the Orthodox Jews believe drunkenness is wrong. And so on and so forth. We could go down the list. The fact of the matter is that most monotheistic religions, the morals or the ethics that are required to follow that religion, largely overlap. There's an awful lot of overlap. Not complete, but a lot, an awful lot of overlap. So what is it that truly makes Christianity different? What is it that makes it different from what it means to be a Muslim or what it means to be an Orthodox Jew? What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus Christ? Ladies and gentlemen, that means first and foremost that we confess wholeheartedly, as absolute truth, that God raised Jesus from the dead. That's what Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 14. What really makes us Christians is that we believe and confess that 2,000 years ago, a man that was put to death on Friday was brought back to life, was resurrected on Sunday morning. A tomb was empty. The power of God raised him to an indestructible life. Death no longer has any power over him. And God did this as a validation and vindication for all that Jesus of Nazareth taught and said. That's what it means to say that God raised Jesus from the dead. That's what it means to be a Christian. And so it's interesting, the earliest Christian preaching always focused on the centrality of the resurrection. On the very first Sunday that the gospel is publicly proclaimed, Peter says in Acts 2 and verse 32, this Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses. And I want you to notice his word there, witnesses. That's important. We're going to make much of that this morning. But that's Peter's testimony on the day of Pentecost, the first time the gospel of Jesus Christ is publicly proclaimed. Later in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 1 and verse 4, Paul puts it this way of Jesus, that Jesus was declared to be the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead. He was declared to be the Son of God with power. In other words, walking around before then, Jesus of Nazareth, he looked like any other human being, and he was weak and liable to death like the rest of us. He may have been able to work miracles, he may have been able to proclaim God's truth, but prior to his crucifixion, he was weak, he could get sick, he could run a fever, and you could kill him, just like any other human being. He had all the weaknesses that come with being embodied in flesh that we have, but when God raised him from the dead, that was the ultimate exclamation point. God saying, this is my son. You may have denied it. You may have killed him for it, for saying so. But this is the ultimate exclamation point. He is exactly who and what he said he was and is. And then you get to later in 1 Corinthians 15, where I've asked you to open your Bible this morning, and Paul puts it this way, if the dead are not raised, if there is no resurrection and Jesus is not raised? And if Jesus is not raised, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So I want to talk with you about the centrality of the resurrection, but what I want to do this morning is I want to talk in particular about the certainty of the historicity of the resurrection. If we are truly a historical religion, if ultimately everything hangs and falls on a historical statement that God raised Jesus from the dead 2,000 years ago, how can we leave this place this morning with that same first century certainty that the early Christians did, that this actually happened? That's what I want to talk to you about in the time that I have with you this morning. And so I want to begin this morning by talking about the importance of assumptions. We live in a time and a place in which we are deeply acculturated to scientific assumptions about how you prove something is true. We live in a world dominated by science, the scientific method, the successes of applied science. We are sitting in a building this morning with air conditioning, lights on, and many of you are looking at the Bible not on a printed page but on an electronic device. We are surrounded by a scientific culture and the fruits of its progress and production. But because of that, we, if we're not careful, we absorb the scientific age's assumptions about the nature of reality and what's true and what's not, and how you prove what is true and so. And so on the screen there, I put a small paragraph. And I want you to do something with me this morning as an opening exercise. Some of you have done this with me in Bible classes before, but many of you may have not. This paragraph is a great tool for learning the power of assumptions and what we see and consider real around us. Look at the paragraph. The paragraph reads this way. The clock on the mantelpiece said 10:30, but someone had suggested recently that the clock was wrong. As the figure of the dead woman lay on the bed in the front room, a no less silent figure glided rapidly from the house. The only sounds to be heard were the ticking of that clock and the loud wailing of an infant. All right, you see that there? So that's the opening paragraph of a book, let's say. If I were to ask you, what's going on in that paragraph? What is that paragraph about? What would you say this morning? Think to yourself for just a moment. What would you say that paragraph is about? What do you think is going on in that paragraph? What has just happened? Okay, got some idea? Without changing the words at all, if I were to say that the title of the book that this paragraph comes from is Murder at Marplethorpe Manor, can you see that in the paragraph? Maybe that's even what some of you were thinking as you were sitting there. This sounds like the beginning of a murder mystery. It's the middle of the night, or at least late at night. It's dark. A dead woman lies on the bed. A silent figure, it's kind of suspicious, a silent figure is gliding rapidly from the house, and all you hear is the ticking of the clock and the wailing of the infant. Perhaps the baby was awakened when its mother was murdered in the death struggle that prevailed in that moment. Okay? But without changing any of the words in the paragraph, if I was to say, no, actually, this is the opening paragraph from a book called The Birth of David Marplethorpe, without even changing the words on the page, have I completely reconstrued what those words mean and what you see in those words and what you find in those words? Sure. Apparently, he was born about 10:30 at night. The reason the woman is dead is not because she was murdered, but because she is his mother who probably died in childbirth. And the person leaving the house silently, perhaps the husband or father in grief, perhaps the doctor in great somberness that he lost a patient. And of course, the baby's crying. Have you ever had a baby? That's what they do when they come out. At least that's what you hope they do when they come out. But without changing the words at all, what we see in them is completely changed based on the assumptions we bring to them, the assumptions shaped in this case by the title of the book they come from. Does that make sense? Do you see that this morning? Assumptions are powerful in what we see. What we see may not change, but what we see in what we see, or what we perceive the meaning or the significance of in what we see. In other words, what's true and what's false, or what we accept as true and false, can be greatly affected by the assumptions that we bring. And so here's the thing. We live in a culture that is acculturated to the scientific method. And how does science work? Well, science on the one column there, science is especially based on what is observable, but there's a bias right there immediately in what science can find as true or not true, right? Because something has to be observable, and it has to be in some way material. And then the other big thing that comes along with science is science also requires it to be something to be repeatable. And so, for instance, if I demonstrate this particular physical law in one laboratory in Australia, I would expect if under the same circumstances in another laboratory in North America that the same results would happen. That if something is scientifically true, and it's not just observable, it is also repeatable. But here's the problem, folks. When we start talking about history, and when we start talking about what is historically true, history cannot be, can never be proven by scientific means. And here's why. Because history is by and large the story of unique individuals living unique lives that only happen once. And so if you're looking for some sort of scientific validation, some sort of scientific reasoning, that's not how history works, folks. That's not how history works. Knowing something scientifically is utterly different than knowing something historically. But because in our time we have been so acculturated to believe the scientific way of knowing is the highest, if not the only way of knowing what is true and real, we have a problem. We come with the wrong set of assumptions to determining what can historically be true or not. There are plenty of things that are true that cannot be proven true by the scientific method. And the fact of the matter is, we are unique in our own time and place, ladies and gentlemen. We are unique in our own time and place that we seem to think that the only truths that matter are scientific truths culturally, that that is the great authority. Remember what was said during COVID? What was the phrase whenever somebody would doubt about the vaccine or about whatever? What was it? It was trust the or follow the science. Because in our culture, that's the highest authority you appeal to, right? That's how it works in our culture. The funny thing is, though, there are plenty of cultures in human history. We don't realize how unique our culture is in elevating scientific knowing to the sole, the only, and the highest form of knowledge, the only road to truth. The fact of the matter is, there are plenty of cultures in history that had what we would call or consider some significant scientific ability that did not elevate that ability to the role of sole or highest form of finding truth in their culture. For instance, the Greeks. The Greeks were very scientifically capable, folks. The Greeks were very scientifically capable. They were great astronomers. They were great mathematicians. To this day, we still call it the Pythagorean theorem. Pythagoras is the guy who figured out that crazy stuff about triangles and hypotenuses. The Greeks were very scientifically capable. They calculated the circumference of the earth to a stunning degree of accuracy in an ancient analog world. And yet the Greeks never elevated their mathematical and scientific abilities to the level of only road to absolute truth. They also knew that there were truths to be found only through, for instance, philosophical reflection, which is why not only did the Greeks give us great mathematicians and astronomers and what we would call early scientists, they also gave us philosophers, because they knew that there was more to the reality of existence than simply what can be observed or what can be repeated. History works differently, folks. There will be problems that occur when we try to put scientific standards up against historical remembrance. One of the hallmarks of history is that by definition, it is not repeatable, but it is real. We are here this morning. You are here because you are the product of a history of a family. And we are here this morning because we are the products of a history of a culture with a culture. It's real. It happened. That's how we got here. Yet it cannot be discerned or ultimately controlled or defined scientifically. Take George Washington. Does everybody agree that he existed? But have you ever seen him? You ever known somebody who's seen him? Well, let's just do George Washington again then. Well, no, that doesn't work that way either. Yet if you were to walk into an American history class and on the test say, when you ask a question about George Washington, I don't believe he existed because I've never seen him, I've never known somebody who's seen him, and we can't repeat him. What's going to happen to your history test? But he really lived. He was the first president. He fought in the Revolution. He fought in the French and Indian War. Truth of the matter is, when it comes to the way that we know something historically, the reality is there are really only two ways that we can prove something historically. Number one, through material evidence, and number two, through eyewitnesses. And when eyewitnesses die, what do we do with it? We write down what eyewitnesses saw, right? Eyewitnesses leave records. But those are the only two ways that we can do history: material artifacts, material evidence, and eyewitness accounts. How do we know George Washington really lived? Well, we have his wooden teeth. And we have Mount Vernon. We have material artifacts of his existence. And how else do we know George Washington lived? Because we have the written records of eyewitnesses who lived with him and told stories about him. Does that make sense? That's how you do history. That's how you do all history. But go back further in time. Go back further in time. Take somebody like Alexander the Great. Anybody doubt that Alexander lived? Anybody doubt that Alexander the Great conquered a huge swath of the known world as it was known at that time? No, nobody does. Now, there's not much material left of Alexander the Great. There's not much material evidence for that. We don't have his wooden teeth. We don't have his estate left behind. But we do have eyewitness testimony. We have people leave behind records who told people this is how it happened. And we have other effects that are noteworthy. For instance, Greek language and Greek culture spread across the ancient world. How did that happen? Well, because this guy named Alexander really did go conquering across the known world and spread Greek language and spread Greek culture. So no one goes into a world history test, and when you're asked about Alexander the Great on your world history test, says, you know, we don't have his estate, we don't have his wooden teeth. And the truth of the matter is those eyewitness testimonies really, really old and ancient, so I don't buy it. There was no Alexander the Great. Now, that doesn't work, does it? We get it. So why is it that people have a problem with the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Because the truth of the matter is, nothing really changes one way or the other in terms of whether I agree that George Washington lived or I deny it and go on the tinfoil hat crowd. And nothing really changes whether I agree or deny that Alexander the Great lived. But if God really raised Jesus from the dead, then everything changes. And so the fact of the matter is, to this day, we still have ample evidence on the basis of how history has always been done that God really raised Jesus from the dead. You still in 1 Corinthians 15? And remember, how do we do history to this day? Material evidence and eyewitness accounts. That's how we do it. Material evidence and eyewitness accounts. Well, look what Paul says. Look what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 3. Paul says this. Paul says, "For I delivered to you of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas," that's another name for the Apostle Peter, "then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive," he adds, "although some have fallen asleep," that means they died. "Then he appeared to James," and here the James would most likely be the brother of Jesus. The apostles were already accounted for. So James the apostle would be accounted for, and the 12 he's already mentioned. This would be most likely James, the brother of Jesus. Then all the other apostles, and there the idea is all the others that have been sent out to preach, people like Philip the evangelist, guys like that. "Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me, for I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle." Now here's what you got to understand about 1 Corinthians 15. We've already read it together in January. That was our January reading together. But here's what you got to understand about 1 Corinthians 15. It was written in the mid-50s. Okay? It was written in the mid-50s. In other words, no more than 15 to 20 years after the resurrection would have happened. It was written in the mid-50s, no more than 15 to 20 years after the resurrection would have happened. In other words, a resurrection event was still living memory for that generation. It was still living memory for that generation. You understand that the distance from Paul when he's writing this and the people that he's name-checking, the distance in time from Paul and those people to the resurrection event is about the same as if this is from you and I to 9/11. You still remember 9/11, many of us? If somebody starts changing the narrative about what happened at 9/11, are there lots of us around who could say, no, that's not what happened? No, that's not true. Of course there are. So you understand the enormity of Paul's confidence in proclaiming the resurrection when he name checks a bunch of people, a bunch of eyewitnesses, in a time when if his story wasn't true, all you got to do is go back to Peter and say, "Peter, was that really how it went down?" And all Peter's got to do is say, no, listen, Paul likes attention. He's embellished it a little bit. Let me tell you how it really happened. And what does Paul do? Paul goes through and he name checks all these people, including significantly 500 at once. Why is that significant? Well, because nobody's having a hallucination in a crowd of 500. Nobody's kind of having some sort of mystical spiritual experience they're going to claim authority for later. If 500 people can all tell the same story, that tells you something happened, right? Any other event in history, we take 500 eyewitness accounts as proof. To this day, if something happened, 500 people say they were there and their story all agree, we'd say it happened. To this day, this is how we in fact verify that something happened in a court of law, right? We put a witness up on a stand and we ask the eyewitness, what did you see? And to this day, what happens in a court of law, what happens every day in downtown in Harris County, Texas, what happens every day is there will be somebody every day, it'll happen tomorrow morning and Tuesday morning and all week this week. Somebody will sit in a courtroom. Somebody will be charged with a crime. Somebody sitting in a courtroom charged with a crime will firmly say, I didn't do it. They will firmly proclaim their innocence. But the prosecutor will run 25 witnesses that will come through and say, I saw him do it with my own eyes. And if 25 witnesses come through and say, I saw it, this is what happened. Let me ask you something this morning, ladies and gentlemen. What's going to persuade a 21st century jury in downtown Harris County, Texas, tomorrow at trial? One person saying it didn't happen or 25 people saying, I saw it with my own eyes? That's still how we determine what actually is true in the past. Because that's what a trial basically is. Do you ever think about that? What a trial basically is where we get together, there's a dispute about what happened, either of criminal or civil nature, and there's a dispute about what happened in the past, and we work together to determine the truth of what happened. And the truth is what's at stake, folks, because based upon eyewitness testimony downtown in Harris County, Texas, what's going to happen tomorrow is somebody's going to be sent to prison for life on the basis of eyewitness testimony, because we understand that you get enough eyewitnesses together saying this is what happened, then that's what happened. And somebody might even be sent to Huntsville to forfeit their life. Because we agree, and we still accept in the 21st century, that when you get together a bunch of eyewitnesses and their stories line up, that, in fact, is what happened in the past. And so here's Paul saying, listen, here's a whole lot of eyewitnesses. Go check it out. Have you ever thought about it this way? Even when they're not directly saying as much, what the New Testament writers are doing, because it's all written by apostles or men who are associated with apostles, Peter writes letters. The Apostle John writes letters and writes a gospel, and so on and so forth. They're all basically agreeing their books are eyewitness testimony, even when they're not directly talking about what Jesus said or did, because the fact that they bothered to write it all says what? I believe in what I saw. I know what I saw, and I know what happened. And then there's this other thing that's going on. Paul, even in 1 Corinthians 15, he lists himself as the great example, perhaps the greatest example of all. Why is Paul such an important witness? Was Paul originally a sympathetic follower of Jesus? No. Was Paul desperate to see his Lord's life and legacy and legend carry on after he died? No. In fact, just the opposite. Previously, Paul was a violent persecutor of Christians, so much so that he would put them into prison, even to death, because Paul, in fact, was so certain that Jesus had not been raised from the dead. For Paul, it was a lie and a hoax. And so that's why in Acts chapter 26, beginning in verse 4, Paul, when he himself was on trial, for saying that Jesus has been raised from the dead. Paul reminds those listening, starting with Festus himself, the Roman leader there, reminds them that he himself is a powerful eyewitness to the truth of what's happened, because verse 4, Acts chapter 26, my manner of life from my youth, spent from the beginning among my nation in Jerusalem, is known by all Jews. You guys know who I was. They have known for a long time, if they are willing to testify, that according to the strictest party of our religion, I have lived as a Pharisee. Hear that? You guys can testify about me. You guys are eyewitnesses about the kind of life that I have lived and what I believed and what I did. But now I stand here on trial because of my hope in the promise made to God by our to our fathers, to which our 12 tribes hope to attain, and they earnestly worship night and day. And for this I am accused by the Jews, O king. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead?" That's a good point, actually. If he's really God, couldn't he do that? I mean, yeah. Now, it's different if I'm saying I raise people from the dead. Yeah, you have right to wonder. But if he's really God, wouldn't you, and especially, you know, you Jews, if he's really God, wouldn't you think that the God who split the sea can handle that too? If you're a Jew, you know, the God who created everything with mere words, don't you think the God who gave life could create life again when somebody dies? Well, that's a good point, Paul. But look what he does. He doesn't stop there. He keeps going. "I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things in opposing the name of Jesus of Nazareth, and I did so in Jerusalem. I not only locked up many of the saints in prison after receiving authority from the chief priests, but when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them, and I punished them often in all the synagogues, and I tried to make them blaspheme, and in raging fury against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities." So how do you account for why Paul suddenly changed his religion? "I was convinced," he says. How do you account for that? Well, because Paul saw a man who was supposed to be dead, alive, when he appeared to him on the Damascus Road. That's what happened. Paul says, "I'm a great example of something had to have happened because people like me don't change our tune that radically. I had too much invested in the life I had. I was too absolutely and utterly convinced that it was all a hoax." But the truth of the matter is the Bible itself, when you keep on going, the Bible itself, other writers invite fact-checking, even beyond Paul. Luke chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken," Luke says, to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were," what now? "Eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting for me, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out in consecutive order." In other words, what Luke is saying basically is, I did my homework, I did my research, I want accurate eyewitness testimony, and this is the record of that. And here's the thing you got to understand. We can't be dogmatic about it, but listen. Luke is writing this in the 60s, most likely, a mere 30 years after. Would there still be people alive who could counter Luke's narrative if he was telling something false? Yes, there are. Absolutely there are. And so Luke says here, look, I'm writing down a researched eyewitness testimony because I want you to know the truth of what you've been taught. Or about little gems like this, little throwaway lines like that we don't often pay attention to, like Mark 15 and verse 21. Where Mark, as he's writing about the crucifixion of Jesus, Jesus is carrying his cross out to be crucified. And remember, Jesus is so wounded and broken by the scourging that he can no longer has the strength to carry his own cross. So Mark 15 and verse 21, "They pressed into service a passerby coming from the country. His name was Simon of Cyrene. He is the father of Alexander and Rufus. They pressed him into service to bear his cross." You ever thought about why in parentheses Mark throws in the father of Alexander and Rufus? Why would he do that? Let me tell you why he would probably do that. So you can go and ask Alexander and Rufus, "Hey, I know your dad's passed away now, but did he ever tell you any stories?" "Oh man, yeah, he told us about this one crazy day in Jerusalem a long time ago. You'll never believe what happened." Isn't that how it works in families? You got family stories that get passed down generation to generation? Everybody takes them as true. What's Mark doing? You have doubts? Go ask Alexander and Rufus. Their dad was there that day. He knows. Or what about this? Acts chapter 26, beginning of verse 25. Paul, in that same trial that we were reading from just a moment ago, says this. He says to Festus, "I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I utter words of sober truth. For the king knows about these matters, and I speak to him also with confidence, since I am persuaded that none of these things escape his notice, for this has not been done in a corner." This has not been done in a corner. In other words, look, Festus, you know there's ripples in the pond right now. There's lots of, you've got to explain why what's going on is going on. This stuff is not secret. I'm not the only one telling you this story. You've heard this. You know what's been going on. And here's the other thing. Look at what he has to say at the very beginning. I am not what? I am not out of my mind. You know why Paul has to say that, ladies and gentlemen? You know why Paul has to say, I'm not out of my mind? Because despite all our chronological snobbery, we're a modern, technologically advanced, scientifically oriented people. We know better now than they did then. No, let me tell you something. Even back in the first century, everybody knew dead people don't come back to life. Think about that. Even in the first century, everybody knew dead people do not come back to life. Folks, they built the pyramids and the aqueducts, and they're still standing and still flowing. They weren't stupid back then. Oh, we're advanced now. They were so gullible to superstitions and myths. Listen, whatever other things they may have believed that we think are hokey now, listen, I promise you 200 years from now, if the world still stands, people are going to be looking back saying, how could they have believed that in 2023? And even back then, they knew dead people do not come back to life. And Paul reminds Festus, this hasn't been done in a corner, Festus. Lots of witnesses floating around. You want to talk to them. Because the issue wasn't evidence. It was the implications of the evidence. If you are Festus listening to Paul, you're forced to recognize that if all this stuff is true, then everything's got to change. The Roman Empire has got to change. Caesar has got to change. How we do justice and politics, that's got to change too. If you're a Jew listening to Paul, all in all of this, all you're thinking is, I make a lot of money off this temple thing, but that's got to change. Or what about for most people? Put yourself in their shoes, because you've been there too. For even the average person, the simple power and psychological shock of the realization that everything I've ever believed and based my life upon has got to change can be extremely overwhelming. And that's where the resistance keeps coming in. That if this is true, it's not that it's be without evidence. We have more than enough ancient eyewitness accounts that if this were anything else, we'd accept it as having happened. It's because of the implications that we try to discredit it. But here's the other thing. If it's not just, as we mentioned, when you do history, it's not just about the eyewitness accounts. It's about the material evidence as well. Can we say something about that really quickly in the last couple minutes this morning? I think we can. Though here's the irony. Here's the irony about that. Though in one sense, when we're talking about the resurrection of Jesus, our evidence is not actually having something. It's not having something. Our evidence is the empty tomb. Our evidence is not having the body. That's actually our evidence. Can we make a pretty solid historical case that the tomb was empty? Yes, I believe we can. I believe we can. Yeah, sure, there have been all sorts of theories that have been proposed over the years about the empty tomb, that the disciples stole the body, or the disciples mistakenly went to the wrong tomb, or that Jesus, my personal favorite, Jesus merely swooned on the cross. He wasn't really mortally wounded after 24 hours of extreme physical abuse, scourged within an inch of his life as it was, then taken out and crucified. The soldier runs the spear into his side. But no, he was just merely severely injured. He regained his consciousness and stumbled out of the tomb a couple days later. Who really needs faith to believe that, folks? Seriously. Think about this. The tomb was empty. How do we know that? Well, first of all, there were too many people who knew where the tomb was for there to be any mistake. Think about that. Who would have known where the tomb was? Well, the disciples, of course, did, but so did Joseph of Arimathea. And so did the Roman guards, and so did Pilate, and so did the Jewish leaders. Lots of people knew where the tomb was. So first thing we need to take off the cable is there was no mistake. And they went to the wrong tomb that first Sunday. And the mistake was made. No, in fact, let's just stick with what we actually have an account for. There was a rumor that was started immediately then, wasn't there? It's actually from the same passage David was reading to us at the table this morning, Matthew 27. Remember what's said in Matthew chapter 27? Matthew chapter 27, beginning of verse 62. The next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor," speaking of Jesus, "how he said while he was still alive, after 3 days I will rise. Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people. Stop right there. Everybody realizes, in fact, I stopped too soon, that he is risen from the dead. Everybody realized that what's the key claim? What has Jesus said before? What are we looking for the apostles to try to pull off of the hoax now? Everybody knows what's the game? What's at stake? He said he was going to be brought back from the dead, and so we're going to make sure the disciples do not engage in a hoax. Lest his disciples go, steal him away, tell the people he's risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first. And so Pilate said to them, you have a guard of soldiers. Go, make it as secure as you can. Folks, too many people knew where the tomb was for there to have been any mistake. So where does the story come from that their disciples stole the body? Where does that story come from, actually? It comes from the fact that the tomb really was empty. Think about that. If the Jewish leaders themselves here in this passage are saying, we know this is the key claim. When the disciples start spreading word that God has raised Jesus from the dead, if they have the body, what do the Jewish leaders simply have to do? Wave the body around. No, you don't. He's still dead. And that strangles Christianity right there in the first 6 hours. That's all they have to do if they have the body. They understand what the game is. If the Romans or the Jews actually had the body, all they have to do is produce it. And that ends this thing immediately, that first Sunday 2,000 years ago. So where does the story that the disciples stole the body come from? It comes actually from the Jews and the Romans because, in fact, they did not have the body. Matthew chapter 28, beginning of verse 11. While they were going, behold, some of the guard went into that city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers. In other words, they bought them off and said, tell the people his disciples did in fact come by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, because that means they failed at their duty, they're liable to the death penalty. If Pilate hears about this, we'll go tell him what's really going on and we'll keep you out of trouble. So they took the money, look at what it says, and they did as they were directed. If they did as what they were directed, then what story did they spread? The disciples stole the body. And look at the last line. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. Why does that happen? Because the Jews and the Romans didn't have the body. They didn't have the body. All they would have had to done was produce it to end Christianity right then and there, but they didn't have the body. And you say, okay, Jeff, that's all well and good, but listen, I need a little bit more evidence than that. Because that's the Bible testifying about itself. I need a little bit more evidence than this. Well, how about this? How about from outside the Bible a century later? How about outside the Bible a century later? This is the Justin Martyr's famous dialogue with Truffaut, chapter 108. This comes from probably about the mid-second century, a hundred years after Paul writes 1 Corinthians, 120, 130 years after the resurrection would have happened. And I want you to notice what Truffaut says to his opponents. He says, although all the men of your nation, and he's talking to Jews in this writing, all the men of your nation knew the incidents of the life of Jonah, and though Christ had said among you that he would give you the sign of Jonah, remember when Jesus talks about no more signs except the sign of Jonah, right? That he would be raised from the dead. That's what Justin is reminding them of. Exhorting you to repent of your wicked deeds at least after he rose again from the dead, and to mourn before God as the Ninevites in order that your nation and city might not be taken and destroyed as they have been destroyed. Remember, Jesus prophesied that Jerusalem would be destroyed because they rejected him. That happened in 70. That's now history for Justin. That's happened too. And he reminds them of that. But keep reading. Yet you not only have not repented after you learned that he rose from the dead, but as I said before, you have sent and ordained men throughout all the world to proclaim that a godless and lawless heresy has sprung up from Jesus, a Galilean deceiver, whom we crucified, but his disciples stole by night from the tomb. Do you see that? What's Justin saying is still the story a century later. The Jews are still saying the disciples stole the body. So that's outside the Bible, folks. Outside the Bible, we have evidence that that is the official story, that the Jews stole the body, still spread by the Jews. Why would the Jews do that? Because going all the way back to that first Sunday, the truth of the matter is they did not have the body. And they knew that. And so they paid Roman soldiers to spread a lie that we have historical evidence for literally a century and a half later. Because they did not have the body. And so we'll leave the rest of this aside for another time. Let me simply end with this then. When it comes to the resurrection, it's really not a matter of evidence. We have more than enough eyewitness evidence. And we could spend a lot more talking about how accurate that eyewitness evidence is if we had more time this morning. But we have more eyewitness testimony that God raised Jesus from the dead, people who saw the resurrected Jesus. We have more verified eyewitness testimony for that from that generation itself than we have for so much else that we take for certain happened in ancient history. And the truth of the matter is we have absolute certainty that there was an empty tomb. The Jews confess it enough, are confessing as much. And the story that was told, that's even verified outside the Bible. So why is it that then and now people resist it? Why then and now people resist it? Is because if it's true that God raised Jesus from the dead, everything has to change. And we don't want that. Nothing ever changes about human nature. And so Jesus himself in John chapter 3, verse 19, reveals what it's really all about and why it's so hard for people to bend the knee and confess him as Lord. This is the judgment, Jesus said, that light has come into the world and people love darkness rather than light because their works were evil. We simply want to do what we want to do and we don't want to change and we don't want to give it up. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light lest his work should be exposed. But whoever does what is true to the light, comes to the light, so that it may be seen clearly that his works have been carried out in God. And so the question this morning is, what about you? Are you resisting the truth of the resurrection and the implications of it for your life? This morning, in this song that reads about to lead us in, are your opportunity to break your will, to disrupt the stubbornness of your heart, and to confess what is the inescapable truth, that Jesus is Lord, demonstrated when God raised him from the dead. And if you're willing to confess Jesus' lordship and repenting of your sins, we'll baptize you for forgiveness of those sins this morning, and you can enter into the life eternal that God has prepared for those who love him, Jesus' own resurrection being the down payment of what is to come. And if you're here this morning, you're a child of God already, but you have quit living the new life, the resurrection life in your own life for whatever reason. The world's temptations, its desires have been too strong and you have fallen. We'd like to pray with you for you, help you in whatever way we can. If you're willing to come and recommit yourself to that resurrection life as we stand and as we sing.